Okay, well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming, and a very warm welcome to tonight's event on Brexit, Rethinking the Future of Higher Education in the UK. My name is Marina Cino Pagliarello from the European Institute here at the LSE, and I will be chairing this session. This event is hosted both by the European Institute and the School of Public Policy, and it is part of the LSE program on Brexit. And as an LSE event, we have our hashtag, LSE Brexit, which you can respond to, interact, and give us your comments. And also, this event is going to be podcasted, and that will be available in a few days' time. The title of this event refers to a wide range of challenges and potential adverse consequences linked to the impact of Brexit in UK universities. And even though there is no certainty yet on what kind of Brexit we should expect by the Halloween deadline, some potential worries have started to accumulate, including the UK losing access to EU research funding, mobility programs and collaboration, the loss of European students and staff, the implication for the financial viability and reputation for the UK higher education institutions by depriving the European education area and the European research area of UK, which is actually one of its strongest members. So we do really have many things to discuss in this respect with our guest and with you. And I'm going now to make their introductions very brief. So it is with great pleasure to welcome and introduce you our speakers. From my left, Professor Edward Byrne, then Nick Hillman, and Professor Julia Black. Our first speaker is Professor Byrne, President and Principal of King's College London. He was a founding director of the Melbourne Neuromuscular Research Unit and the Centre for Neuroscience in 1993. He was previously appointed the Vice Provost at University College London, and he held that position until becoming the 8th University President and Vice Chancellor at Monash University in 2009. And he also received the Australia Highest Honour, Companion of the Order of Australia in 2014. Then we will hear from Nick Hillman, who since 2014 is the director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, which is an independent think tank devoted to higher education. He worked for the Honourable David Willetts, now Lord Willetts, the Minister for Universities and Science from 2007 until the end of 2013, and as Chief of Staff and then Special Advisor in the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills. Last, but by no means least, our third speaker is a very familiar and important face here at the LSE, Professor Julia Black, and she's currently Strategic Director for Innovation. She was previously the Pro-Director for Research, and from 2016 and 17, she also served as LSE Interim Director. And she's currently leading on the implementation of the Future 2030 LSE Strategy, LSE's entrepreneurship and commercialization activities, and she led the development of the PhD Academy here at the LSE and the new School of Public Policy. So we do have a wide range of expertise from our guests, and I look forward to the discussion. I'm inviting the speakers to speak around 12-15 minutes. I know it's not much, but in this way we can maximize time for questions and comments from the audience. So, before inviting our first speaker, Professor Byrne, to speak, please join me in giving our guests a warm welcome tonight.
Yeah. Let me start by saying how pleased I am to visit the LSE. I've always regarded it as arguably the most distinguished institution of its type in the world, and for a humble academic neurologist to speak here is rather unusual, so thank you very much for inviting me. My remarks are very pragmatic and from the co-face, and I'll depend a little on my colleagues to the left to pick some of the more intricate detail. But clearly the UK's decision to leave the EU in 16, after the referendum, was always going to be contentious and a source of uncertainty for businesses, for public sector organisations, for universities, their leaders and their people alike. I don't know if it was always clear it was going to be quite as difficult as it's turned out to be, but it was always going to be difficult. It's almost 3 years since the historic vote, and in the midst of political deadlock and a delay to the UK's exit, possibly until the end of October of this year, or even longer, it's easy to think of the old saying, everything changes, but nothing changes at all. That seems to be almost where we've been. But for our academic institutions, especially our world-leading universities, one of which I lead and another one is here, much has already changed. We've had to take stock of the fact that inevitably our approach to international engagement in terms of education, research and broader service, and we'll hear more about that, will need to adapt to a post-Brexit reality. Attitudes, behaviours and relationships will inevitably be different. Of course, at present, we don't yet know the final destination of the Brexit journey, be that an accidental no-deal outcome that can't readily be repaired, a long transition period leading to a looser future relationship, or a more straightforward future relationship based on close alignment and association with EU programmes, which, of course, most in our sector would very much like. Or most dramatically, starkly dramatically, no Brexit at all, which could, of course, unleash a whole set of other challenges to societal cohesion, although I sometimes feel they are exaggerated a little. Now, preparing for these various eventualities has challenged my current university, King's, to think about who we are, how our vision for the next 20 years or so, we've called this Vision 2029, reflects who we are, and how we then deliver our plans for growth, diversification, and academic development in the case of much, much more uncertainty than we would normally experience in the university world. As I say, these challenges, of course, are far from unique for universities. They apply to businesses, especially the City of London. Preparing and implementing contingency plans that involve the relocation of offices and staff to other EU member states or the shifting of assets to European jurisdictions is going on all around us in this city at the moment. At King's, one of the research-intensive civic universities in the UK and in London, we can't do this. While we're globally engaged, we are clearly locally rooted. Our connection to our locality, to London, is what enables us to be an effective international community that serves the world. London is a major factor in our identity and our influence, and we can't just pick up sticks and move, nor can the LSE, I believe. I know this is also true for other universities. So in line with the title of this symposium, Rethinking the Future of Higher Ed in the UK, I think our response to Brexit requires us to firstly reassess ourselves, how we connect with our localities, how we engage globally, and how we make the world a better place in the way that great universities do. It has obliged us to rethink how we operate internally, how we forward plan to mitigate change, more change than we've perhaps experienced in normal times, and how we communicate to reassure our community to the greatest extent we reasonably can when we share often that uncertainty as university leaders. When external events to a far higher degree than usual are out of your control, they're fast-moving and unclear, and while also they're the subject of intense media coverage and debate, it poses a source of great anxiety for university communities, for staff and students, and I bet many of you in the audience have experienced that, and immediate and real communication challenges beyond that we normally deal with in our world. Our priority at King's, and not uniquely at King's, since the week immediately following the vote to leave, has been and will remain our people. Communicating clearly and regularly with them, especially our staff, and especially those staff who come from the European Union, being honest with and supporting them in every way and in any way we can. A primary risk for all organisations in this part of the world following the vote was European citizens' rights. This caused immense anxiety. Over a quarter of our staff at King's come from the continent. I believe it's more at the LSE. 15% of our students, I bet it's of that figure or more here. Almost all the uncertainty of Brexit, amidst all of the uncertainty, perhaps the most pressing early thing was this issue of right to stay for Europeans, continental Europeans. And the EU settlement scheme provided a welcome certainty in an area which was really great after 2 years of uncertainty to have announced as non-negotiable by both the UK government and the EU Commission. You know, this came incredibly late and caused huge distress. Anybody who has interacted with the Home Office before, and I've done quite a bit of this though, may share my pleasant surprise at the speed upon which the scheme was eventually operationalised and the speed at which the vast majority of applications are now being processed, which is a breath of fresh air in a rather turgid story. At King's, we chose, before the government covered the cost, to fund applications for all staff and their family members until the fee was removed, as I say. This type of thing is not so expensive, but it's a message of institutional support. And I think in a situation where you can't move the major levers, to do what you can in terms of messaging of support is terribly important. This was clearly the right decision. It demonstrated the value we place on our community. Now, a year ago, our sector was rocked, less so here than over the road, by the most acrimonious strike in living memory in the university sector in the UK, the pensions dispute. This exposed a worrying gap between university leadership and the people we seek to serve, our staff and our students. Historically, there may have been an institutional tendency to adopt a highly cautious approach to communications in the face of uncertainty. Don't say much and it'll blow over. The disastrous publicity around the strike blew that approach away. And a combination of Brexit's public profile, its source, its impact on our external environment has moved us to take a very open approach with our people, students and staff. That is, if we know something, they know something. There's no secret agenda. A multi-level communications and engagement strategy based on honesty, reflecting to our people the areas where we don't have answers, and they appreciate that, they read the media as we do, seems to have helped maintain trust and confidence. We don't offer false hope or rosy, baseless platitudes of reassurance. We try to share the uncertainty and pain and talk it through. We considered carefully the choice of words we use with each communication, and we take on board and continue to take on board the feedback we receive over time to optimise the way we communicate. I think as a university or vice chancellor equivalent, the most important thing I've been able to do is put a lot of effort into communications to the community. Part of the communication has, of course, been explaining to our people the steps we've taken to protect our activities, the risk to Erasmus Plus funding and a no deal, or potentially in an extended transition, was something we could help, because if we lose access to the next EU budget for 1 or 2 years, that's a real problem. So we've committed ourselves to covering that risk internally and funding all affected exchanges to ensure continuity in those programs. You know, it's a risk of a few million. We can take that risk. That's something we can do as an institution. Clearly, EU research funding, and we'll hear more about this in a moment, and I don't want to steal any of Professor Black's thunder because she knows much more about this than I do, but it has been an area where the importance of leadership engaging directly with our people has been the key to reassure researchers while acknowledging the limitation of our knowledge about the future arrangements by stating repeatedly how crucially important these links are for us. I won't go into too much detail about what we're doing to diversify our research base at King's, but we are developing a much stronger network of collaborative relationships around the world with bilateral and multilateral relationships in Europe and outside. We're building up expertise to better access to other key global research hotspots, especially in Asia. But that, of course, said the greatest issue is retaining access to Horizon Europe, and that must be a key priority. Likewise, and this perhaps has impacted on us more than anything, we're already seeing reduced recruitment from the continent. Should international fees be applied to EU students, as we now hear is very likely from 2020 on, that's going to be a major detrimental factor in student recruitment in all likelihood. So addressing a challenge like Brexit has forced us to be agile in planning and working across functions and thinking perhaps more creatively about our position in the world. That there's some truths we can no longer take for granted in the way we could. We're learning a lot about how we can better work together through this process. It's meant that our strategy and planning function works more effectively with our external relations function. We've had to really start to think laterally about where our staff and students come from in terms of filling potential gaps in continental recruitment while fighting as hard as we can to maintain access and links with Europe. The scope of impact is broad and encompasses every aspect of our operations as a university. We've had to work collaboratively to identify risks and opportunities and prepare. We've had an oversight group covering key areas, working diligently now since Brexit was initiated. This has strengthened our commitment to continuing to strengthen and improve as an institution. I can't say it's been an easy journey. I can't say that there won't be very difficult hurdles still ahead of us. But universities are intrinsically internationalist. Knowledge, our commodity, is international. Having a diverse global community and a strong base of global partnerships is central for us. It's not a negotiable, minor thing around the side. So a key focus for all great universities, and we're certainly on this journey, is to continue to attract the best people to come to work with us and study in us. We are developing, as I've said, bilateral relations, and some of these are becoming quite novel. With Technical University of Dresden, we've now developed a trans-campus deanery that has about 100 joint academic appointments, mainly PhD and master's programs supported by that. We're launching strengthening links, and I know you have those at LSE also, with Sciences Po in Paris, but also very excitingly with the new University of Paris, the combined Paris Descartes and Paris Diderot, which have come to us, and because we find the major continental institutions also want to strengthen links. We've developed a unique alliance called PLUS Alliance with the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, and Arizona State University that now has almost 200 quite distinguished academics in it and a whole raft of research programs, and every prospect that we'll launch a joint new university initiative together in the not too distant future. These are things I don't think we would have done a few years ago that have been forced on us, but will make us stronger. I won't mention China. I mean, we've got masses going in China. Two new King's campuses underway at the moment. Again, I think this has been a result in significant part of preparing for a broader world engagement. Now, I don't want this for one second to imply that we're giving up on Europe. You know, we're trying as hard as we can to maintain every possible link we can with Europe. I'm not going to say a great deal more because I think I've covered most of it. Obviously, the collaboration between UK universities, driven by one of our professors, Anand Menon, who has many collaborators here, has contributed to the public debate. The leadership that the LSE has shown in the public debate, I think, has been incredibly valuable for the whole sector. There are many risks ahead of us in this journey, but we cannot let this political uncertainty make our sector stall. We have, for our size as a country, weight for quality, the best university sector in the world, and we must continue to develop this in terms of our excellence across everything we do and not give up on an internationalized look at any time. when the Prime Minister said, and you know, I know it's difficult times, and I'm not critical of anybody in more senior roles, to be a citizen of the world is to be a citizen of nowhere. I think everybody in our sector winced just a little. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. That was a very interesting testimony of how universities are attempting to prepare for Brexit.
No,
it was very useful to listen. Thank you. Now, Nick Hillman, who I think has for us some amazing slides, isn't it?
Yes, I think they're all here already. Fantastic. I'm just going to set a timer to make sure I don't go on for too long. So thank you very much for inviting me to speak. It's a great pleasure to be here. I head up HEPI, the Higher Education Policy Institute. We're the UK's only specialist higher education think tank. We're supported by lots of institutions, including King's and the LSE, and we're very grateful for that support. We're a charity, so when the Brexit referendum happened, we didn't take a position. We would have been against our charitable obligations had we done so. But I do have views on the whole issue, hence why I'm here. And I just want to start with one historic slide. I actually think our sector, and universities pay my salary, and I love working for our sector. I think, as Ed said, we have one of the best sectors in the whole world. But I think they did play their hand badly in the referendum in 2016. There are three reasons why I believe that on the board. I can give you specific examples, though there isn't time at this moment to do that. I think the campaign they ran, the Universities for Europe campaign, was too inward-looking. There were staff and students were overwhelmingly pro-Remain, and the ones that weren't were not going to change their view. So we should have had they should have run a much more outward-looking campaign if they wanted to change people's votes. I think it was too one-sided. Again, I've had conversations with some people in this room about that before, and I think it was too focused on money rather than the uses to which that money was put. The Monday after the referendum, Shearer West, who's now Vice-Chancellor of Nottingham and was then a Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield, was on Newsnight, and she said, this is catastrophic because we'll no longer be able to fund this dementia programme, which is bringing researchers from around Europe together to find ways to stem dementia. Those sorts of arguments we didn't hear that much of during the campaign. And I'm not just being wise after the event. There's an article I wrote in July 2015, a year before the referendum, saying I thought the campaign was going to be fought badly by universities, and I think it was fought badly by universities. But, of course, Brexit was voted for by 52% of the population, and from the moment that happened, we need to be looking forward rather than looking back. And this is actually an article I wrote in The Guardian the day after Brexit. I didn't go to bed that night because it was all so exciting. My arguments may or may not work in that. But from the moment the referendum happened, I've been arguing that the sector needs to think constructively. Remember the concept of an international travelling community of scholars, which is the heart of the concept of higher education, predates European nation states. It predates. It easily predates the concept of a European Union, and we mustn't lose that just because of the vote that happened. I've been asked to talk about policy. We're a policy body. You may have seen over the weekend, BuzzFeed, the website, ran this story saying it made out as some great big leak that the government were going to start charging EU students the full international fees, which tend to be higher, and stopping EU citizens who come here to study from accessing the tuition fee loans that mean they don't have to find the money up front. That was at the weekend. There's been a big argument on Twitter as to whether this is a surprise, a bad thing or a good thing. Jonathan Simons, who's actually on the political right, on the political right, used to work for Policy Exchange, called this short-sighted, vindictive, counterproductive, unpopular, unsustainable. I think there was a bit of an echo of that in Ed's remarks just now. I think it's always been pretty inevitable from the moment the Brexit happened that those things would happen. We're either in the club or we're out of the club. And if we're out of the club, then there isn't really a rational justification for saying EU students are treated differently to people who hail from much poorer countries. If you're interested in that argument, I wrote a long article on a website. You'll find references to it on Twitter yesterday explaining the argument why this is a difficult issue. But it shouldn't have been a surprise, because back in 2017, my organisation published this report here, where it remains the most detailed piece of work that anybody's done on what is likely to happen to student demand post-Brexit. And I'll just take you through the figures incredibly quickly. Only look at the ones with green. It's a complex piece of work, but we essentially found that if EU students have to start paying the full international fees and are no longer entitled to tuition fee loans, then there'd be a drop-off of 57%, the first green point, in EU students coming to the UK, and that the consequence of this for tuition fee income for universities would be a reduction of nearly 40 million, the second green thing. Less than you might think, because the ones who still come are all paying the higher fees. There is a counter argument to this, by the way, which there isn't time to go into, that the numbers may not be as bad as this, and I'm happy to chat about that afterwards, because if in very short, if universities can charge EU students any fee they like, there's a real incentive for universities to go and find those students the way they use agents in China and India and other countries. But of course, Brexit did something else, which is often forgotten about, which it led to a big reduction in the value of the pound. So here is the value of the pound against the dollar. The red arrow is Brexit Day. Big reduction the day the result came in on that. And in fact, post the referendum, the highest point value of the pound is about equal to the lowest value before the referendum. So big reduction in the value of the pound. And that makes us cheaper for people to come and study here relative to some of our main competitors, like Australia, like New Zealand, like Canada, like the United States. So when you factor that in, there is an argument that the change in the value of the pound might actually bring more students to the UK. And the numbers there are on the slide. This is 1 year entry. So we said it might lead to about 20,000 new entrants coming in, leading to about £250 million a year extra fee income for universities. And when you tot all that up, the net numbers, and you take off the EU students who won't come and add in the extra students who will come, we found there'd be a reduction of about 11,000 students each year in total. But because all the ones that are coming are on the full international fees, universities might actually be better off to the tune of nearly £200 million a year. Universities would probably be less diverse, though, because you'd have to be very wealthy to come or have your government pay for you. And, of course, the consequences will affect different universities in very different ways. So what this chart shows is the yellow is UK-wide figures, and the other three colours are individual universities who I'm not allowed to name, but one of them is the LSE, by the way. And what this shows is, first of all, publicly funded teaching. So these are home and EU students. Home and EU students are pretty much bang on 100%. So home and EU students, pretty much, their fees cover the costs to educate them. It's pretty even. Non-publicly funded teaching, so this is non-EU students, full international students, Indians, Chinese, Nigerians, people like that, because they pay the much higher fee, they pay far more than it costs to educate them. The lowest one here is 139% of the cost of educating them. So universities are making a big, healthy surplus on those people. Universities are charities, they don't waste that money, they reinvest it in things that are underfunded, and the thing that is very clearly underfunded in Britain is research, because when you get a research grant, it doesn't cover the full costs of research, and so there's a big cross-subsidy, but it's differently sized in different universities. And though those numbers I showed you before are sector-wide, the finances of different universities will be affected very differently. Again, I'm very happy to talk more about that. So what should happen now? Well, I think universities messed up the Scottish independence referendum because they refused to get involved. I think universities messed up the Brexit referendum for the reasons I've said. And I think they're messing up for a third time in relation to referendums now, because it's very clear that most people working in universities are very pro-Remain. But ever since they got the shock on the 23rd of June 2016, they're not really getting stuck into the debate. And I've argued that university should call for a second referendum. I think Michael Arthur, the Vice Chancellor of UCL, perhaps made the clearest case last time. He was accused at the launch of Universities for Europe and other places of politicising the debate by getting his great big university behind the Remain campaign. But what he said was, and I think it's absolutely valid, wherever you are in the debate, he said, I am the Vice Chancellor of this great institution. My job is to protect this great institution. My calculation is Remain is better for this great institution than Leave. Therefore, I'm going to put my shoulder to the wheel. Now, it doesn't matter if you agree with that or not, but that is his job as a Vice Chancellor, I would believe. And if Vice Chancellors believe that remaining in the EU is the best for the sector, there's no particular reason why they shouldn't get as involved in the campaign for a second referendum as they did, as I say, in perhaps the wrong way in the first one. So at least that's what I've argued. And I think there are three strong arguments they could make in relation to that, each illustrated by one of the things on the slide. So there's this two members of parliament in the House of Commons dining room, one saying, I don't want the soup and definitely not the lamb. My friend doesn't want the melon and is fiercely opposed to the fish. In other words, parliament can't decide anything. They know what they don't want, but they have no idea what it is they do want. And if parliament can't decide, then there has to be another mechanism. Secondly, you know, I'm not a big fan of referendums, but once you've gone down this route, there's an argument you have to go on at least for the same issue that you've taken to the country once before. And I think it's a very strong argument that if you're taking the vote on the theory of Brexit to the people, there's a very strong argument for taking a vote on the practice. And secondly, everyone says we're a country that doesn't have referendums and no history of referendums. Well, you can see there have been 12 or so referendums before the 2016 one. It's very hard to argue that any of these is as important as the issue of our membership of the European Union. And so, again, the argument that it's not an important enough issue to go back to the country, I think, is perhaps warped. But I was also asked to say, what is the impact of Brexit on higher education policy? Well, first of all, nobody really knows what Brexit is, even the Prime Minister, and we don't even know for absolute certainty how it's going to happen, if at all. But one risk for higher education policy is everything else gets forgotten about. And in the 5 years that I've been director of HEPI, it's been the busiest 5 years in the history of British higher education. And the pace of change has been incredibly fast. People like Ed and Julia have had to deal with it. If you're in a think tank, it's good material to write about. There's a list of some of the changes that have happened on the board. I'm not going to talk through all of them. But we're living through a time of unprecedented volatility in higher education. And the risk is all these other things are not being discussed to the degree that they should be being discussed because of Brexit. And to give you one example, the government a couple of years ago announced what's called the Augur Review, a review of university, well, actually all post-18 education and funding in England, announced a couple of years ago. The report is apparently lying on ministers' desks in Whitehall. It's just being properly dealt with, being published, being discussed, being debated, being implemented because Brexit dominates everything. And another thing no one in the sector is talking about, but if we lived in normal political times, we would be talking about it endlessly, is the spending review. Every 3 or 4 years, and I used to work in Whitehall, every 3 or 4 years, the government decides how much is going to be spent on every government priority and every government department for the next few years, called a spending review. Normally, we would be talking about nothing other than this. No one's talking about it, but it could determine how well off, how sustainable institutions like the LSE are in the future. And then my very final slide is the government recently announced an international education export strategy. Sorry, some of the fonts have got a bit mucked up there. But the government says they've got these very ambitious plans for education exports up to 2030. They're actually not at all ambitious because their old plan was the blue line and their new plan is the yellow line. So they're less ambitious than their old plans. But we're nowhere near, and Joe Johnson, the former universities minister, says this in public, we're nowhere near going to stay on the yellow line if Brexit happens and we don't have a reasonable strategy for expanding our educational exports. So things like the overall post-Brexit migration rules, how long former international students can stay in the UK to work, what the salary threshold is, how much bureaucracy there is, how easy it is to come here. All these things need to be considered as part of the post-Brexit migration rules. But again, that issue is not having the focus it would have done if maybe, I don't know, there'd been a clean Brexit and we were now talking about the better
possibilities. So so I wanted to end on that because there is this new educational export strategy. The government has these targets. Unless we have sensible policies, they're pie in the sky.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Right, so it lies to me. So the challenge always being the third speaker at the end of an interesting row of very stimulating speakers to think, well, what the hell am I going to say that hasn't already been taken by everybody else? But I think, and I just have a caveat to start off with, which is I have a number of hats at the LSE, but I'm also a board member of UKRI, and all my comments are in the personal capacity of either me or me in my LSE role, and not in my capacity in the head of on the board of UKRI. I just get my disclaimer out there. I also have a background in law, so probably that's why I sort of attend to these things. So I think so the future of higher education after Brexit, I completely agree, and there are a lot of similarities between King's position and the LSE position. We are both global universities. We're both rooted in London. We're not going anywhere. We did have a sort of joke just after the referendum that perhaps we'd just be the London School of Economics in Paris, in wherever you were. But actually, you know, we have London in our name. You know, we're not going to go anywhere. So I think for universities, the challenge is, and for the university sector as a whole, how to deal with the massive set of exogenous risks, actually, which we have had upon sort of foisted upon the sector, visited upon the sector. And as Nick's slide was fabulous in actually bringing out the fact that Brexit is actually only one. And at various points I have said to people, you know, wasn't it great when actually just participation in Horizon 2020 seemed like the biggest problem we faced? Whereas now it's just one on a long list. So where do we go? I think, first of all, I completely agree with Nick that universities have been absolutely useless at making their case and were not good in making the case for Remain. In their defence, no other Remain, anybody interested in Remain, was good at making their case either, and that's arguably why we ended up in the case in the position that we are. But I think one of the failures that I would add to Nick's very accurate and quite long list is we didn't mobilise our students to vote. And one of the things we know is if we changed the demographic of that vote, we would have changed the vote. We didn't mobilise our students to vote. Now, whether that stemmed from the complacency, the echo chamber, which we have particularly in London, to be honest, if we talk to colleagues elsewhere around the country, then that echo chamber is much more porous. You know, they know their islands have remained in a sea of Brexit, as it were, where we just thought we were island. There was no island, right? Everybody was just sensible. Rightly or wrongly, that was just what you have when you have that frame. So I think one of the reasons why universities have been shy so far of participating in the next frame of the debate is partly because of conscious that we got it wrong the first time, but also I think because since then universities have had the additional shock of the political establishment turning against them. And following a highly populist line in relation to universities, which meant that we've actually been without any kind of defenders. And so our voice has been completely delegitimised and has been delegitimised by the press and by government, being active participants in that delegitimisation. Now, I'm delighted that ex-university ministers are now coming out in support of the university sector. It would have been wonderful if they'd been as vocal in their support whilst they were university ministers in some instances. But the issues about vice-chancellor's pay, fat cat salaries, student debt, etc., has mean that in terms of our voice and our ability, therefore, to critique power, has been not taken away necessarily, but certainly disempowered. So our challenge, therefore, in facing the various forces, exogenous risks that we have, is to find allies who are willing to come and vocalise with us the importance of universities. Now, Nick is absolutely right that one shouldn't necessarily focus on figures, and we know that the Brexit debate is not an analytical debate, it is an emotional debate. But at the same time, it is worth pointing out, you know, that the UK university sector supports over a million jobs, it contributes over 21 billion to GDP, that But I think the difficulty then is, well, what does that really mean? And lots of universities have had reviews and assessments done of their economic impact. But in terms of what that really means to a locality, this is quite interesting because the government is quite schizophrenic here, because while it's delegitimizing universities on the one hand, on the other hand, and I flip between rooms and debates of both of this character, universities are seen as the saving grace for the industrial strategy. In fact, the industrial strategy doesn't have much other than research, universities, and mobilizing that in order to foster innovation, drive innovation, etc., through the economy. And as part of that is a recognition of the very importance of place. So take Nottingham, for example, which Nick referenced, Shira West, who's there. If you roll back 20, 30 years, then Nottingham had a big shoe industry, had a range of other industries there, and it had two relatively small universities, Royal University and a polytechnic. Now you go to Nottingham, Nottingham has two big global international universities, well, one more local, one more global, and kind of that's it. The universities are providing the cultural life, they're providing the employment opportunities, they are the bedrocks, as it were, of economic activity, growth, etc., within their regions. And that is, if you're sitting in some of the big civics, it feels very different sitting in London, but if you're sitting in some of the big civic universities, then they are the anchor institutions. And they're the ones which are training the workforce. They're the ones which are working, go to Sheffield, working the local FE college to retrain. They're the ones which are setting up the innovations, the accelerators, the startups, etc., and spinning them out. So I think in terms of the political discourse around universities, we have a completely, I think, unique for our time. I've no idea why historians will now go away and discuss, potentially, or not be that interested. On this kind of bifurcation as universities as the saviours and universities as, you know, the failures, okay, to deliver. And I think the bifurcation of the responsibility now for universities between BEIS and UKRI on the one hand and Department for Education and the OFS on the other is really only exacerbating that tension, okay? And there's nobody actually looking out for the sustainability of the sector as a whole. Okay, so where to go from this? I mean, you've had an amazing set of contributions, both from Ed, from a the standpoint of the university and what that means, and from Nick, from a more macro perspective. Universities thrive on human capital. We aren't anything other than our people, both our faculty and professional services staff and our EU students. And we know the stats, and the LSE is slightly more. We have 34% of our faculty is from the EU, 25% of our professional services staff, 18% of our students are from the EU. And we don't make up for the rest with the UK. Actually, the bulk of the majority of both faculty and students are international. So we are fundamentally global. And we didn't just wince, actually, on the Citizens for Nowhere, but I went out very proudly and said, I'm delighted that we are Citizens for Nowhere, and we're absolutely going to stay that way, because that's our character. But therefore, I think some of and we can reel off the figures. So from an LSE perspective, then we've received 41 million in EU funding over the last 4 years. About 35% of our research funding comes from Horizon 2020. We've collaborated in over 200 different collaborations. In the course of the Horizon 2020 programme, the UK as a whole is the biggest winner of collaborations. It's the second biggest winner, as it were, of research money overall. Got over 2.3 billion so far in the last Horizon 2020 round, 19.4% of all funding, blah, 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 blah. But actually, what does that really mean? That really means that really excellent science is being done. And we know from all the citations, analysis, to the extent that that is valid, that at least international collaborations produce the most highly cited research, with all the flaws that there are in those particular metrics. So the challenge is, how do we can probably survive, of course we can survive in a world where the infrastructures which we have been relying on for collaboration within the EU, i.e. Horizon 2020, Erasmus, freedom of movement, etc., where those infrastructures are no longer open to us. So we have to rebuild our own infrastructures. So we can survive. The question is then, how can we thrive? And I think, as Ed said, that this has been stimulating for the sector in the sense that, oh my God, there's a kind of stimulation, but also it requires a new set of imaginations. I think actually, were we to have, and this is my personal view, a second referendum in which Remain campaign did a hell of a better job in making the case, ourselves included, and we ended up staying in, I think universities would actually be in a better place, having had to go through the process we've just been going through, than we were had we not had to go through it. Why? Because we've had to rethink our reliance on those structures we just took for granted. So we've had to work harder at thinking about new international partners, new ways of collaborating with EU institutions, not just relying on an Erasmus scheme or, you know, we can just collaborate as we like. We've had to look at different forms of collaboration and different ways in which we can absolutely fundamentally engage without being reliant on a state or multi-level infrastructure doing that work for us. So I think if we, the best case, from my personal point of view, is we stay in and we continue with that type of work and that type of attitude which has been stimulated by the situation that we're in. But it's not to say that we don't face, as a sector, incredibly real risks. And I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much. Thank you all also for the brevity of the intervention, and in a very short space of time you have raised many topics and covered a lot of issues, and I'm sure there are a lot of interesting questions from the audience. Perhaps I could start with one question myself, and my question is about on the future of EU-UK relationship in higher education, which was maybe the last point you were mentioning. And we know, as it has been pointed out, that the UK is a very important research partner for Europe, is where all key research facilities are located, is a popular destination for students, for staff, and so on. So, on the one side, cooperation with European countries matters a lot. At the same time, EU countries compete with each other for international students and for EU research funding. And maybe for some European countries that they offer courses in English, like Germany, the Netherlands, Ireland, Denmark, perhaps should the UK leave the EU, a lot of international students might decide to go elsewhere to study, also because it is also assumed that a lot of international students come to study in the UK, not only for the reputation of the university, but also because the membership of EU is very attractive as well. So they might not come anymore, and all numbers and figures might be, you know, different. So my question is, on the one side, we have cooperation in research, and on the other, we have competition over students. And which will be, in your opinion, the stronger driver? Are we going to expect more competition, an increase of competition with degrees, or more cooperation, less cooperation? What is your opinion in this moment, of course?
Well, let me start. I think we're already seeing a huge desire for increased collaboration because, you know, this is every bit as difficult for our European colleagues as it is for us. So I have never had as many European research university presidents come through my door and want new collaborations. We're a foundation member of the Guild of European Research Universities. I think just about every member of the Guild wants to do something with us. There are all sorts of new programs emerging. So I think on research, you know, there will be massive links going ahead. And the key thing will be what the funding arrangements are. And will they be as good as they are now? They probably won't, so how good will they be? On education, I don't think there's any real problem at all. The, you know, for the top end of the Russell Group, which includes King's and the LSE, we are universities of selection. You know, we have so many international students applying to come. We can only take a proportion of the qualified students. So I could fill King's three times over with international students. And if the number falls off from Europe, we've got so many applying to come from other parts of the world. As Nick said, and I agree with Nick about his overall assessment, by the way, for the sector generally, the issue is, when I ran Monash in Australia, we had 25,000 international students on campuses in Melbourne. Half of them were from mainland China. You know, it leads to an unhealthy uniformity. We had classes where 80% of students were from mainland China. Whereas here at the top UK universities, the international students come from everywhere. And the European students, we've got nearly 1,000 French students at King's at the moment. You know, they contribute enormously to the diversity. Now, the other factor to bear in mind is that it may well change, of course, but at the moment, for rectors in France and in Germany, and in many other parts of Europe, there's very little financial advantage to taking an international student because the legislation is they have to charge local rates, which is virtually nothing at all, so they have no financial benefit. If that changes, I think Europe could be much more competitive, but you know, the number of international students in the world is figured to grow from 3 million to about 9 over the next 10 years. I think there's plenty of scope for great institutions.
I agree in terms of the top institutions. I think in relation to the sector as a whole, if you were to look at the entirety of the university sector, then, you know, King's LSE, we are very well positioned. To be honest, if we don't survive, nobody's going to. But there are the universities who have built their growth strategy on growth in student numbers and growth in international student numbers. Now, to be fair, they haven't built that strategy on the growth of EU student numbers because they don't come with enough. They don't come with any higher fees. So the loss, that loss of EU students in terms of how that will impact on their financial model, is. As Nick said, it depends whether or not the devaluation of the pound means that they can compensate with the international students because, you know, buy now while stocks last. And I must say that we've found an increase in the applications for our international students during this period simply because of the devaluation of the pound, or for EU students who are paying master's fees. So, you know, exactly how that will work out is difficult, is going to be difficult to say. I think on the issue of collaboration and competition, so yes, absolutely there is competition for student numbers. There is also competition in research, yeah? So, and again, this is part of the schizophrenic strategy that governments have towards universities. So they require you to collaborate on the one hand, and then they measure you independently as single institutions and pit us against one another, for example, in the REF. But that's a national issue. But in terms of, you know, there are other countries which are actively seeking to build up their research and science base. Germany is investing heavily in this area. France, as you can see with the European universities, the way that Macron is going, they are really seeking to invest heavily in their base. Switzerland is a key competitor, and in terms of, I'm afraid, faculty recruitment, there's no way we can compete. They're even out-competing the US, you know, in terms of faculty competing. So the idea that everything's lovely and cuddly in research land and it's a bit more cutthroat in student land, you know, it's not as clear-cut as that.
Okay, thank you.
I agree with everything that's been said, and so I'll just be very brief, but I'll just say we mustn't talk down the strengths that our sector has, and Ed and Julia have talked up some of them, and one of them is the strength and breadth across research. So there are lots of countries in the world that are really good at some areas of research. There aren't many countries the size of the UK, arguably no countries the size of the UK, that is as good across as many disciplines as we are. And if the future is interdisciplinarity, if the and so on and so forth, then we mustn't forget that as well. So that's just the positive. It's very easy to sink from that into arrogance about the strength of our sector and assume everything that's been good in the past will continue. I'm absolutely not saying that, but we need also an honest assessment of where our strengths currently lie so that we can build on them even more.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we'll open the questions for the audience. I will take questions in groups of three, so just please say who you are and keep your question short, okay? Colleague is coming with a microphone in a second. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to pick up on Nick's point. I saw his comment in the press about if we're coming out, Brexit means that there must be an equivalence of fee levels between international and EU students. I wonder to what extent, though, we could see some kind of bargain that under various forms of Brexit, the proposition is that we would wish to remain part of the European research area. would we not envisage the possibility that charging nothing more than the current fees for EU students might be part of the entrance fee to the European research area? Is that possible?
Maybe I'll take a couple of questions. Anybody else? Yes, the lady in the middle with a jacket.
Thank you. You spoke quite a lot about the interface with the public in terms of potentially influencing the debate if there were to be a second referendum. I was just curious to know what sort of interaction has been had with government and how receptive they've been.
Thank you. Yes, the lady with the white shirt in the middle.
Hi. I also wanted to pick up on a point that Nick made about a second referendum. In terms of universities getting involved, is there a risk that that could further increase the difference between those who are educated and those who perhaps aren't, and risks in terms of social mobility? So people who might be the first in their university, in their family to go to university, that might be further ostracised as well.
Thank you. So let's start. Who wants to reply to Kevin?
I mean, one of the very first one, I guess, was aimed at me, so I'm happy to forget. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right that if it's less of a clean break Brexit and more of a slightly fuzzier Brexit with soft edges, then probably everything's back in play, including potentially student fee arrangements. But I think there's two caveats to that. I'm told, I don't understand the legal position, but I'm told by some lawyers and not by all lawyers that there are legal, it'll be very difficult legally if we're not in the club to have different rules for EU students and other international students. I say personally, I have a moral question about it as well. But I think there's another issue too, which is when we come to sign trade agreements with non-EU states, when we sign that big trade agreement with India, won't they ask for the same as whatever we've just given Europe? So actually you're then back to a level playing field again. So I think it's a really interesting area, and we will see how it plays out. My own fault, I'm sure. I didn't completely understand the second question. Sorry, was it the interface with government about a second referendum?
Not specifically, but that would be a potential example.
So the interface between universities and government about everything?
Well, I mean, not everything, literally everything.
Yeah. Well, there was a moment a couple of years ago where universities were being kicked in the press every week, and it continued, of course, during the strike, as Ed talked about. There was, at that very moment, every representative group for universities in the country, Universities UK, the Russell Group, other sector bodies like UCAS, Office for the Independent Adjudicator, they were all undergoing a leadership change at exactly the same moment. HEFCE was being closed down and the Office of Students was being set up. And there was a real vacuum there, which we suffered from. Back channels, as you heard in the introduction, I used to work in Whitehall. I think back channel communications between the sector and civil servants are actually generally pretty good. But a lot of that is behind the scenes. And then the final question was on if you had a second referendum, would it increase the division between educated and non-educated? Maybe it would. Perhaps it would. But I'd also say I think there are ways around that. I think the way around it is to show how universities touch the lives of everybody. And as I say, if you can show that a European research project in a particular university is working to cure that horrible disease my grandmother died of, to be honest, I think it doesn't matter whether I went to university or not. That is a valuable project to me. And I think the bit that doesn't cut through is Universities UK did focus groups recently about universities, and nobody spontaneously mentioned, no member of the public spontaneously mentioned the research that universities do. They knew about it when asked, but nobody's, it's not never at the forefront of people's minds when they're thinking about universities. But it's the research that touches the lives of non-students more than the teaching.
So I'm happy to come in. So I think absolutely to Nick's point, we need to be really cautious and really aware and alert to the way in which various aspects of universities may become bargaining chips in future trade agreements. Fee levels, access to research funding, post-study student visas. We know as soon as Theresa May went off to India, her first visit, she said, oh, let's have a trade agreement. He said, yeah, fine, if you give us post-study work visas. Otherwise, no thank you. So, and I think if we are to find ourselves as universities suddenly having our, we're in an odd position as universities because part of our, some of our price is set, is fixed by the government. So we're private, semi-public, we're a bit like care homes, right? So and government sets the fee at what they think we should be charging, not what it costs, right? So, and you see the number of care homes that close down. So I think, you know, if we suddenly need to find that our international fee levels are being traded away in a trade agreement, then we are really in trouble financially for the reasons that have been put up. So we need to be absolutely alert to that, and I don't think we have been sufficiently astute on that yet. Though I have to say that the international representatives at UUK are absolutely all over this, and so in terms of the sector representative, they are very strong. In terms of engagement with government, Nick is absolutely right. One of the turnovers, I can't say, Ed and I, and I don't know how many dinners and coffees and breakfasts we've had with successive university ministers, and we look at the next one that comes in and say, oh, he looks quite good. Let's try and keep him for as long as we can.
He is quite good this time.
You know, so, and every time it's a teaching, right? Every single time it's a teaching. So with Tony, Kevin, you know, I've walked, as has Ed, as has every other university vice chancellor, just that we can walk to Whitehall and there is a furrow in the pavement personally which we have made going down the Strand to get there to try and articulate the case. Are they receptive? Government, as you can see, is highly fragmented. And so that means that you know that your touch points, you can't just say to one person if they say X that that is a government position. You have to, you know, you have to touch point the whole time. So it's just absolutely, are we on the case and eating? Are we eating for the sector? Yes, we are eating for the sector. I think the point about the second referendum, I think probably might come in terms of, as an employer, right? And taking that people, we have to recognise that people will have different views. And I had the joy of being interim director just after the referendum result came in. Was basically the day I kind of took over as interim director. Hurrah! And the first message I put out publicly when speaking to staff was that statistically 30% of people at the LSE who employed at the LSE will have a voting age, and at the LSE of voting age will have voted to leave. Okay, and that we have to remember and that we have to respect. So it is, you know, it is something that you cannot, you are, as a leader of an institution, you can't assume that everybody is personally going to have the political viewpoints that you have. So, but that is why I think, as Nick was saying in reference to Michael Arthur, it is actually, as an institution, no matter what one might think is good for the country or good for the motor industry or good for taking back control or good for immigration, etc., as an institution, it is in our best interest to stay within the European Union. But that's how you have to bound it. So, because I think you're right, otherwise there is a risk of alienation and it's a very complicated message to project both internally and externally when there's absolutely no difference between what you say externally is seen internally and what you say internally is seen externally. You can't have two different messages.
I'll comment briefly on all three questions. The first, I just don't know, but if universities lose the ability to set their own fees for international students, we'll be almost unique in the Western world in that respect. And that would be a massive attack on university autonomy. So I don't believe that will happen. You know, it doesn't happen in the States, Canada, Australia, or any of our competing countries. But the difficulty there is, has already been said, what the conditions of entry are for international students. And, you know, I think I don't need to say any more about that. It's all been covered. But the other two issues that have been raised, I've changed my thinking on this a bit. You know, I couldn't be more pro-Remain as an individual, but I saw, and it was pointed out very graphically, how totally ineffective we were as a voice in the referendum. In fact, we probably lost more votes than we gained through our interventions. Two things to that stand out for me, and I think these are just pragmatic observations. You know, the first is that any friends we have in the right wing of UK politics, we totally lost. And we've got a right wing government at a time when the university sector is more remote from government than it has been in living memory. When all sorts of, you know, loss of autonomy type initiatives are coming forward, and all sorts of discussions are underway that are resulting in the end, you know, I believe, in real weakening of our sector at a time when we've lost friends because we were so one-sided. And it just raises the question, you know, something like universities that represent such complex constituencies, to what extent should we get behind a particular political position, even if personally we believe it? Now, I did last time. I couldn't have been more pro-Remain. I didn't sign the letter that Michael Arthur signed because I don't think it's politically helpful at a time when we have a Conservative government and are likely to for some years, you know, just pragmatic thing. But much more importantly, and I don't think we've quite faced up to this, it's voiced a lot and it came out of the last question. You know, 52% of the population did vote Leave. More than half the population come from families that benefit very little from universities. They're low-income families. They don't own their own residences. They don't have a professional exposure in their family tree. Their children have little chance of coming to a university like this or King's. They haven't benefited from the massive growth in wealth that we've seen in this country over the last 20 years. They're disenfranchised, and we are part of that. We are part of that problem. And in the end, you know, that's the core problem here. It's why we've got Brexit. It's why when we speak to ourselves, you know, yeah, we listen to each other. You know, I have a lovely chat with colleagues from Cambridge and LSE and whatever. We all agree, you know. But the people who we'd have to get to change their mind, they're not benefiting from what we're doing at the moment in the way we need them to. And this is a deep-rooted problem. You know, it goes beyond Brexit. It's a deep-rooted problem in the social structure of this country at the moment.
Thank you very much. Should we go with a second round of questions? Yes? Second row? There's a microphone coming to you.
Thank you. We've had two powerful interventions from representatives of the Russell Group, world-leading universities. We've heard a lot about research. We've heard very little about the wider function of universities and, in fact, the university sector as a whole. I'd really like to know, and perhaps Nick is maybe the person who will be able to say something about this, about how you see the rest of the sector. I think both of the million plus, the universities with largely local populations. I also think of the very specialised creative universities like the College of Music, RADA, and so on, who can't survive without very close links with the universities. Where do you see both the wider education case for university and the position of these other universities who are not in the Russell Group?
Thank you. Yes?
Thanks a lot. I wanted to ask if, thinking about the slide, one of Nick's slides where he had two columns of other things going on at the moment which are impacting on what is in effect a rapidly changing higher education landscape in the UK. So I wanted to ask members of the panel to reflect on, in the context of Brexit, if they could pinpoint what they see as being quite majorly significant in shaping the thinking of higher education leaderships at the moment. I mean, I think of the TEF, the Augar Review, the new obligations universities are facing under access and participation plans. How is this impacting on sort of strategic thinking of universities? And then there's Brexit going on as well, which is a sort of backdrop to all this.
Thank you. Any more questions? Okay, maybe you want to answer?
Yeah, I'm very happy to. I mean, I think Anne's question, the first one, is very pertinent, and I know policy should not be set on the basis of anecdote, but I agree with the point you made, and it was brought home to me incredibly powerfully when I was visiting the Royal Northern College of Music the other day, a very specialist institution, quite small, it's so specialist, very high quality. And they said to me, if you're putting together a really world-class orchestra and you need people who are proficient, you know, world-class proficient with different instruments, is that you have to go out there. Because so, for example, the example she gave, people in this room will know if this is true or not, but she said bassoonists tend to come from Italy. So no one in the UK learns the bassoon, apparently. World-class bassoonists come from Italy. So if you're putting together a world-class orchestra, you need an Italian, probably, in it. And that is, I think, is a real practical example of how tougher rules could affect. So for them, whether we're in or Europe or out of, you know, in the EU or out of the EU is one issue. But also the ease with which Italians can come if we are out, you know, actually what are those post-Brexit migration rules are very important. And on the other sort of million plus end, so the former polytechnics, newer, younger universities, I would say, I mean, some of them, of course, get less money from being in Europe. They don't get so much research funding. They may have fewer EU students there. So they are also, and this links to the second question, they are also worried about all the other things on the sector at the moment. And there are universities in the country that are very, very close to financial insolvency. Very close, closer than any time in living memory. In fact, no British university in the history of higher education has ever gone bust. And there are some that are incredibly close to going bust. If the Augur review then reduces tuition fees, or some other, or the Chinese, let's say there's some massive spat between the UK government and China, you know, masses of students come from China to UK universities, that would pull the rug. So, and I think that links the first and the second question. There are all these other pressures going on. And the one thing, because you asked about, the second question I asked about, you know, strategic priorities and stuff for universities. The one thing I think is going to be a big issue in the next few years is the quality of the governance of universities. University managers are accountable to university governors. And university governors are much more important than they were because the Office for Students says, we're a market regulator. You know, report to, if something goes wrong, you've got to report it to us. They're a market regulator. They're very different. University governors have become much more important in this country than they were a few years ago. And I'm not totally convinced every university governor up and down the UK has realised that, or that the quality of university governors is necessarily reflective of that, and we will see it if and when a university hits the wall. I'm sure the LSE and King's are brilliantly well governed, by the way.
So, I mean, I can completely endorse what Nick said, and I think the, I mean, your question was really in two parts, different points of vulnerability and what's the university sector ever done for us type question. And the sports specialist institutions are highly at risk because of the nature of their faculty and their students, and absolutely to those points of mobility. As for the and the why, the pressures are therefore differently felt across the sector, and you have, you know, very different pressures at the specialists than you do for the kind of the broadly brush post 92s for the Russell Group, etc. And whilst there's always a tendency to kind of homogenise the sector in order to make a point, but there is quite a strong recognition both politically and within the sector itself in terms of the different points of vulnerability, shall we say. In terms of, the wider societal question, what have universities ever done for us? And this is... this goes well beyond what we can countenance in terms of a discussion here, but I think it roots right back actually to the way, and this is a David Willetts argument that he makes in his book on universities, that our entire education system is geared towards the production of 3 A-levels by 18-year-olds in order that they can then go to university. And that over-specialisation at the same time that you have, so we know we have a massive skills agenda that we need to pursue within the UK. John Kingman, who's chair of UKRI when he was looking at this and wrote a speech relatively recently, within recent months, which had the quite alarming statistic that if you are studying at A level, a STEM subject outside of London, then your chances of being taught by a teacher who has an A, so if you want to study a physics A level, your chances of being taught by a teacher who has a degree in a STEM subject, any STEM subject, not just physics, is about 18%. To say that is not good is to use the British understatement to its quintessential meaning. So in terms of that skills agenda, whether it's, you know, whether we have A levels, whether you have T levels, what the role of FE is, etc., you know, we have to look right from that fundamental. So what's the role of universities in that? Actually, on that is training. You know, it's actually providing those skills at different levels. But I think what we need to have from the Office for Students is the ability to differentiate. Now, they say that, But actually, when you look at the policies that are coming down, there are no way they're a market regulator. I am a market regulator with another one of my hats, and they are way more intrusive than any market regulator would ever be. I also campaigned very hard and successfully to have an overall provision put in the Higher Education and Research Act to protect university autonomy, which is in there, just by the skin of its teeth, but which we, you know, have to battle for every single day. So we are, you know, as I say, coming back to this schizophrenia in government about what they want universities to be doing. We don't, if it would be great if we just had two views, to be frank, but we have very, very unthought out from UKR or from Bayes on the one hand, which is research over here, but in relation to, you know, what the social engineering function, as it were, that universities are meant to be performing, that's coming out of the OFS and the Department for Education, in my personal view, there is, let's say, a distinct lack of clarity on what they're asking from the university sector to deliver.
I'll just go back, I think, to where I finished the last comment. Somebody like me, my whole life has been thinking internationally and globally about research impact in my field. And I've come to realize, as a result of the comprehensive loss of confidence in the UK and our university system, that we need to not only present what we do well, and Nick alluded to that, particularly our research achievements, but we need to do some things differently. Impact on society, we have to do more of it. We have to make it clear to the communities around us that we're interacting with them much more effectively. I don't want to mention King's too much, but over the last 5 years since I've been leading it, we've been pivoting in that direction. We could fill King's with upper middle class students. We don't do that. A third of our students are first in family, undergraduates, 50% of BME. The Times Higher recently measured or developed a new social impact scale or ranking for some 800 universities put through it. And it measured equity and diversity, measures of inclusion, measures of social and society impact, measures of productivity, 10 measures in all. We came fifth in the world in King's. 20 years ago, we wouldn't have come 500th. You know, this is a change in attitude to be as relevant as we can in improving lives, not only for the young people who come through our doors, but for the societies and communities around our campuses. I think every UK university needs to focus on that more and more. And, you know, very hard for LSE, very hard for King's. We're stuck in the middle of this mega city, but we can still do it. We have to get to a position in the next few years where somebody whose child may not go to a great university understands that universities are more than finishing schools for middle-class children. Now, we're not, and nobody who knows universities thinks for one second that we are, but there is a view out there, and we have to very proactively just do better in being relevant to the community in the United Kingdom. And that, to me, is the key Brexit message, funnily enough.
Thank you very much. Any more questions? Maybe I can do the last question, also related to your last point. I don't know, do you think that Brexit might also be an opportunity to recalibrate a bit the university landscape in the UK, in the sense that maybe universities from the south will start to recruit from the north of the country, or maybe universities like elite universities might start to recruit students from small institutions in a more widening participation access? Do you think Brexit can also change a bit of this dynamic, or we will continue to attract only international students?
To be honest, just as Ed was saying, I think that goes absolutely to the point. And I think it's not so much Brexit as the reasons why for the Leave vote, whether we end up in or out. Okay, the political impact of having had a Leave vote, as I say, whether or not it ends up with us leaving or not, subject to second referendum, and God knows what happens after that, I think that has given a fundamental change to to the rethinking of policies, framing of discourse, and the framing of positioning of institutions, big institutions, including businesses, actually, but for universities as well, and that attention, you know, more to the local, and what are you doing in your local community as well as what are you doing in your global. As I say, it does, however, feel very different sitting in London than it does if you are elsewhere in the UK, where London universities, we have to kind of shout to be relevant because there's so much else going on.
Yeah.
You don't need to if you're Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, Nottingham. It's a very, very different position to be in.
Well, I think there is something important and cathartic about the conversation. And maybe cathartic's an odd word to use given I was in Westminster today and seeing all the protesters. But there comes a moment in the life of countries where you have to have a conversation about the position of your country going forward. And whether or not we stay in or we leave, this is one of those moments. This is recalibrating the course of the country in a very profound way, whether we stay in or whether we leave. But your question was really about the structure of the HE sector, and I'm not totally convinced it's going to have that effect. I mean, someone mentioned David Willetts' book earlier. There's a very interesting chart at the beginning of that book where it shows the growth of universities in Europe. Most universities gradually got a university sector. We didn't. We had Oxford and Cambridge 600 years before we had places like King's. And that model, you know, that has had profound consequences on how higher education has grown up in the country. And that, you know, the fact that two of our universities are among the two most famous institutions in the world, but 600 years older and on a very particular model, that's a profound consequences, which are very long lasting. And I'm not sure that's going to change. If you want to know how the sector could change, we published a really interesting publication by the Vice Chancellor of Middlesex University, who says, basically, if comprehensive schools are right, if you shouldn't have selection in schooling, why should we have selection in higher education? We should have comprehensive universities where, so long as you have a minimum school leaving qualification, you can go to your local university. And there's no hierarchy. All the universities are more similar. It's much more similar to how some European countries do it. But when you read that report, you think this is a really interesting argument, but how on earth could you apply that to the current shape of the British HE system, particularly the English one? Thank you.
I think we will see better links between different types of institutions. I think it's just going to be crucial going ahead. And having spent quite a bit of my career in Australia, where the links are much more effective and real, I think there's massive room for improvement here. So, you know, I hope we see links between prestigious metropolitan universities and regional institutions. I hope we see joint programs. I hope we see a lot more effort at national cohesion. Is at least one, you know, minor positive development, not driven solely by Brexit, but by contributed to by it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, I would like to thank a lot our speakers. It was a very interesting discussion, so let's see how things will progress with Brexit. So let's see about the future of all these aspects, and thank you very much to the audience for the engaging discussion.